that lead-in music. Welcome to another Tuesday edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host, Dave Allen. Melody taking care of clients today. For all your gold and silver needs, call Melody toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. If today's your first time joining the program, welcome. If you're a repeat offender, well then, welcome back. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you my opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Today is Tuesday, March 22, 2022. Happy National Goof Off Day. And oh, how I'd like to. But it's also National Diabetes Alert Day, which is observed annually on the fourth Tuesday in March. So I have to be a little more serious. This one-day wake-up call informs the American public about the seriousness of diabetes and encourages everyone to take the risk test and learn about your family's history. I'm now over 10 years into type 2 diabetes with a grandmother who died from its complications back in the 1980s. So I, for one, take it seriously by trying to watch what I eat and drink and what I don't eat and drink. Make sure I get some exercise every day or two. You should too. Let's get started with today's market report. A challenging day for gold. After hitting a high about 1932 earlier today, at down about 14 bucks, 0.75%. Right now, 1922 and change in the New York spot aftermarket. Silver down 1.7%, 42 cents at 24.87. Platinum also down about 1.33%, 14 bucks at 1,031 an ounce. And then palladium has had a rough day. It actually was down as low as 2,400 today. It's now down 4.2%, $106 at $2,570. In the various paper markets, bear with me one second. We've got WTI, domestic crude oil, down about 0.7%, 82 cents a barrel, closing right now at $111 and change. And with the dollar index relatively flat, technically down 0.04 on the day at 98.46. We've got a bond market that is actually down on its par values. We've got just about all maturities showing higher yields today. The bellwether 10-year yield at the 2.38%, and the 5-year 2.4. As it rounds to. Last but not least, let's take a quick look, excuse me, at cryptocurrencies. Last I saw, yeah, still up. Bitcoin up about 3% at 42,366 and change. And back to the stock markets, you have the Dow Jones. Up 254 points, big day today, 34,807. You got the S&P 500 up 50 points at 4,512. And the NASDAQ up 270 points at just about 2%, 14,109. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's market report brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, if you have any questions you'd like to ask or brief comments you'd like to make on today's program, please call in toll-free at 844 844-769-2944. That's 844-769-2944. We'll try and fit you in. Now, the war in Ukraine leads our news again today, where Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has called for more pressure on Russia as war appears to be entering a period of stalemate. Amid few wins for Russian forces, aside from the cowardly airstrikes on Ukrainian civilians and apartment buildings and homes and hospitals and daycare centers, and a continuing staunch resistance from Ukrainians, Kiev claimed today that 15,000 Russian soldiers have now been killed so far in the fighting. Russia itself says that number's a lot lower. I'm sure it's somewhere in between. But President Biden said Vladimir Putin's back is against the wall now, and he could resort to using more severe tactics, referring to chemical or biological weapons. Yesterday, Ukraine rejected a call to surrender its southern city, Mariupol, to the Russian forces, with President Zelensky stating that Ukrainians will fight till the end. Meanwhile, the Pentagon said Ukrainian forces, including civilians, have put up a strong resistance, and the Kremlin struggling to achieve its goals. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. has airlifted 4 kids with cancer out of Ukraine so they can continue their treatment in the U.S. Children were transported to St. Jude's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, where St. Jude said it's the first U.S. hospital to receive pediatric cancer patients who will also receive trauma-informed psychosocial therapy in addition to their medical treatment. More than 1.5 million kids have fled Ukraine since Russia's invasion on February 24th. It's according to UNICEF. Heard a number today, about 3.5 million people overall have fled, mostly women and children, number of men as well. Far more have been displaced from their homes and separated from their families, even placing them at a high risk of human trafficking. Meanwhile, a senior U.S. defense official said Russian forces are still largely stalled on almost all fronts in Ukraine as the nearly one-month-long war marches on. The unnamed official told reporters that the Russian military is increasingly beset by logistics, command and control issues, and morale problems. We even hear about a number of Russian troops leaving their tanks. More of them actually been taken out of the fight because of frostbite, because of inadequate uniforms. Now, back here in the States on Capitol Hill, U.S. Supreme Court nominee Ketanji Brown Jackson in Senate confirmation hearings again today, day number 2 of 4 scheduled. She pushed back against Republican accusations that she was too lenient in sentencing child pornography offenders. She said, as a mother and a judge who has had to deal with these cases, I was thinking that nothing could be further from the truth. Now, last week, you may have seen Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, another member of the panel, said that Jackson showed a pattern of letting child porn offenders off the hook for their appalling crimes, both as a judge and as a policymaker. But independent fact checks from numerous media outlets called that claim misleading, while Durbin and other Democratic colleagues have quoted a conservative columnist who called Hawley's argument meritless. The 51-year-old Jackson, who, if confirmed, will become the first black woman to sit in the Supreme Court, portrayed herself as an independent jurist, as a number of people praised her qualifications. Jackson, a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, previously met privately with many senators on Capitol Hill, including all in the Judiciary Committee. Now, if confirmed, she would succeed the retiring Justice Stephen Breyer. Jackson, in her first appearance before the Senate committee yesterday, offered a defense of her career, saying she looks at her cases from a neutral posture and applies the law without fear or favor. She said, "I don't think anyone could look at my record and say it is pointing in one direction or another that is supporting one viewpoint or another." The mood at the hearing was calm and cordial at first. Grassley prompted laughter from the room when he told the judge that his wife said she had enjoyed Jackson's remarks yesterday, but had not said the same about his own speech. But the tone shifted during questions from Senator Lindsey Graham, who began his time by asking Jackson about her faith. He asked, quote, "On a scale of 1 to 10, how faithful would you say you are in terms of religion?" That reportedly led to some senators and a lot of attendees in the room to quickly turn their heads in perceived shock. Graham also pressed Jackson about a brief she wrote as a public defender on behalf of detainees at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. As some criticized her time as a public defender as being soft on crime, she responded that she is only hard against injustice. So her confirmation hearings, again, are scheduled to conclude on Thursday. Now, in economic news, almost half of employees are looking for a new job or plan to soon, according to a new survey suggesting the pandemic-era phenomenon known as the Great Resignation is continuing into 2022. To that point, 44% of employees are job seekers. That's according to Willis Towers Watson's 2022 Global Benefits Attitude Survey. Of that 44%, one-third are active job hunters who looked for new work in the fourth quarter of 2021, while 11% said they plan to look, another 11% that is, said they plan to look in the first quarter of this year. Tracy Malcolm, who's the global leader of the future of work and risk at the consulting firm, said, "The data show that employees are prepared and open to go somewhere else." The survey polled over 9,600 U.S. employees from large and mid-sized private employers across a broad range of industries in December and January. The Great Resignation has been a hallmark of the labor market since spring last year, when the economy began emerging from its pandemic hibernation and demand for workers grew significantly among businesses, particularly in the service sector. Job openings and quits swelled to historic highs and layoff rates fell to record lows. And wages have risen quickly as businesses have been competing for that talent. Nearly 4.3 million people quit their jobs in January, just shy of the monthly record, I think, of 4.5 million set in November. Almost 48 million people quit in 2021, an annual record. That's pretty astounding. It suggests that most aren't quitting to just sit on the sidelines. A strong market with ample opportunities and higher pay are luring them to find work elsewhere. Some are reinventing their careers altogether. 56% of workers said pay is a top reason they'd look for a job with a different employer. 41% would leave for a 5% increase. Wow. Just a lot of unhappiness or dissatisfaction with their current work life. Households have been battling persistently high inflation, which has eaten into budgets and outstripped pay for the average worker. But almost 20% said they take a new job for the same pay, suggesting that factors other than wages are important as well. Health benefits, job security, flexible work arrangements, meaning hours worked as well as working remotely at home, as well as retirement benefits. They were actually behind pay as the top five reasons employees move elsewhere. Currently, 26% of survey respondents are always or mostly working from home. 15% have an equal split between home and the office, but higher shares, the 36%, would prefer remote work. Now, staying here in the States, U.S. oil prices rose 70% over the last year. Meanwhile, U.S. oil production rose by just 5%. Domestic oil producers aren't rushing to respond to soaring prices. In other words, don't expect a flood of American crude to drive energy prices back down anytime soon. Memorial Day is coming. So why aren't American oil companies, especially in the oil-rich shale patch, pumping like crazy to rake in even more dough? Experts say it isn't as easy as flipping a switch. For one thing, they're probably making ample profits these days. But also, to pump more oil, you have to increase spending on exploration, drilling, and or production. And that's become costlier and more difficult because of, well, supply chain issues and rising input costs, i.e. pay. Case in point, frack sand. In order to break the shale formations that contain oil and gas, the drillers pump a high-pressure cocktail of water, sand, and chemicals into these wells they dig. But sand is much more expensive these days, tougher to find, and getting trickier to transport. Canadian Pacific Railway told investors last week that it can't move as much as frack sand as the demand is out there. Frack sand currently costs $40 to $45 a ton. That's up as much as 185%, almost triple from last year. There are other issues too, such as, you know, can you get the trucks to move it to where you need it? And it's not just sand. I mean, you got drilling, steel, labor, diesel fuel. They're also rising in price, or they're hard to find, or both. Several years back, when shale drillers were known for their speculative spending in drilling, the American oil industry might have been more than willing to boost production in the face of $100-plus oil. But a lot of those companies went bankrupt during COVID when the oil prices collapsed. Well, bottom line, there's no indication that an investment boom is underway to significantly boost American oil production. And even if there was, nothing guaranteeing it's going to lower prices any time soon. Hey, I hear that noise. Means it's time for a short break. Stick around. Financial Survival will be back in just a few minutes.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Call us again toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. Last week, Eurostat, that's the EU's statistical agency, released a report of the euro area's February inflation rate. It wasn't a happy report. Consumer prices were up 5.9% from a year earlier, more than most analysts had predicted, and it's only going to get worse as the effects of the Ukraine war weigh on food and energy prices there. And the UK hasn't released its latest inflation number, but the Bank of England expects it to match the rate again in the euro area the previous month, probably higher. Of course, U.S. inflation is higher, with February consumer prices up, around 8% from a year earlier. That's a minimum. These numbers aren't exactly comparable, the U.S. and EU, for technical reasons, but inflation in the U.S. does seem to be running around 2 percentage points higher than in Europe. But surely the fact that inflation is up significantly in a lot of countries, not just America, well, it's worth noting. Europe, interestingly, however, had nothing comparable to Joe Biden's American Rescue Plan, trillions of new dollars in the economy to account for that additional inflation. Last year, the euro area's structural budget deficit, as a standard measure of fiscal stimulus, was only about a third as large as a percentage of GDP, anyway, as the U.S.'s. So why is inflation up so much in Europe? Well, you guessed it. A good part of it is rising energy prices. In late 2020, gasoline in the UK cost 116 pence per liter. That's $5.94 a gallon. By mid-March, that was up to $8.23 a gallon. Over the same period, U.S. gas prices rose from $2.24 to $4.32 a gallon, almost doubling. Thus, taking the U.K.'s high gas taxes into account, well, price increases were pretty similar. But it's not just energy prices. U.S. inflation has been driven up in large part, too, by pervasive supply chain problems. With the big shift of demand towards goods straining ports, shipping capacity, and more. I mean, these same strains, which have lasted a lot longer than many expected, have afflicted Europe as well. So what does this high inflation in Europe tell us? Well, first, that a large part of the acceleration in U.S. inflation reflects global forces rather than specifically American policies and developments. Second, because these global forces may abate, we finally emerge from this dark tunnel of the pandemic and now war, well, U.S. inflation may eventually decline, even without drastic changes in policy. Of course, inflation is running hotter on this side of the Atlantic. Why? Well, one main factor almost surely is that the U.S. economy has recovered faster than that of Europe. In the fourth quarter last year, inflation-adjusted GDP in the U.S. was 3% larger than it had been before the pandemic, while the euro area had barely recovered its losses. And in case you're wondering, you don't need to discount those numbers for faster U.S. population growth. Our working-age population has, in fact, stagnated since before the pandemic, thanks largely to a collapse in immigration. And U.S. economic growth has helped workers as well as GDP. Although hourly real wages have been eroded by inflation, total labor compensation is up almost 14% since the start of the pandemic, compared with only 5.2% in Europe. Now, excess inflation suggests that recent U.S. economic growth has been too much of a good thing. No, our economy looks clearly overheated, which is why many economists believe the Fed's right to have started raising interest rates last week and should keep doing so until inflation subsides. But while overheating's a problem, we shouldn't let it overshadow the good things that have already happened. We recovered fast from the pandemic recession, although try telling that to the millions of people still unemployed. And for now, we've avoided the long-term scarring effects that may have feared, that many feared. But to that, again, I say, well, let's actually wait for the long term. Most, though not all, of the inflation we're experiencing reflects probably temporary global forces, and multiple indicators suggest that longer-term expectations of inflation remain anchored. That is, I mean, higher inflation isn't getting overly entrenched in the economy. But if we're talking about the same thing here or worse 6 months from now, well, that's another story. And there's still the question why so many Americans feel so lousy about the economy, or at least they tell pollsters they feel lousy, even though they're spending as if they're optimistic. And they're charging a lot of that spending, going further into debt. Now, we're not necessarily unique in that respect. European consumer sentiment has also taken a hit in the face of inflation, although nothing like the nosedive we've seen here. For now, it probably makes sense that Americans look at our economy in the European mirror. Recovering from the pandemic was always going to be tough, and Vladimir Putin has certainly made it tougher. But under the circumstances, hopefully, we're going to be okay. Just to be sure, make sure your portfolio has adequate amounts of gold and silver. It's the best way to provide your family with the insurance they so richly deserve. 800-375-4188 for all your gold and silver needs. Oleg Kashin, a Russian journalist living in London, has a compelling guest essay in today's New York Times. Here's what he had to say, and I'm going to quote it word for word. In 2003, 4 years into President Vladimir Putin's tenure and with liberal politics at a nadir, I visited the Moscow office of the center-left Yabloko Party. There, among the 50-something inveterate anti-communists who dominated the party, sat a 27-year-old staff member, Alexei Navalny. We quickly became friendly. We were members of the same generation, the same culture, and we had the same views about good and evil. Plus, we spoke the same language. Though we didn't always agree, I felt that he and I were, to quote Rudyard Kipling, of one blood. It was obvious that such a man would feel cramped in a stuffy old party, and so it turned out. But it wasn't at all obvious that Navalny would rise to be the undisputed leader of the opposition. His challenge to Putin's rule was so profound, in fact, that it would lead to the regime's effort to silence him. Through attempted assassination, imprisonment, and illness that last week threatened to tip over into death, and to thousands of Russians across the country taking to the streets to protest his mistreatment. Russia now has two national leaders, an autocrat in Putin in the Kremlin, and Mr. Navalny, who today was sentenced by a Russian judge to 9 years in a high-security prison on a bogus charge. When we first met, such a future, if someone had been back from 2021 to tell us of it, it would have seemed far-fetched. At the time, an opposition movement was slowly taking shape, and it, you know, comings together of opposition figures united in their disagreement with Mr. Putin. If little else, I would often see my old acquaintance, Alexei Navalny. He understood that real political life was there, not in his own party, and he rapidly became one of the notable figures of the opposition. His expulsion from Yabloko in 2007 for participating in a nationalist demonstration, which he'd attended out of solidarity with the nationalists facing the Kremlin's repression, wasn't any great loss for him. He had already created a name for himself as the author of a popular blog. So while others cursed Mr. Putin and held protests for freedoms of assembly, Mr. Navalny set to work exposing abuses in state corporations and accusing the authorities of thievery. Criticizing corruption was more convincing than slogans advocating democracy. Yet the turning point for the country and for Mr. Navalny came a year later in 2011 when Putin decided to become president of Russia again, and his party, United Russia, gathered a wildly improbable majority. Mass protests broke out. The leaders of the opposition, who had grown accustomed to seeing 100 or so people at their gathering, suddenly found themselves looking out at tens of thousands of citizens. Tempting at this point to say there was a leadership competition that Mr. Navalny had won, but alas, that wouldn't be true. There were many other leaders as well here, the liberal Boris Nemtsov, the communist Sergei Udalstov, the nationalist Alexander Potkin, former prime minister Mikhail Kashinov, and chess champion Garry Kasparov. But one after another, through assassination, intimidation, imprisonment, and blackmail, they disappeared from the scene. And that left just Mr. Navalny, leading some to suspect he was working for the Kremlin. An impression bolstered by the fact that in 2013 he was publicly released from prison and allowed to participate in the Moscow mayoral election. A strategy employed by a very coy Putin. Those are my words. If any suspicions lingered, even after he was given another suspended sentence and attacked with green dye, they were decisively ended in August last year when Mr. Navalny was apparently poisoned aboard a flight to Moscow. It became clear that the Kremlin had simply been keeping Mr. Navalny for dessert. Mr. Navalny insists that his poisoners acting on Putin's orders intended to kill him. But perhaps, as an investigation by the Dossier Center, as financed by the former oligarch Mikhail Khodorkovsky, a Kremlin critic who spent nearly 10 years in prison, suggested the plan was not to kill Mr. Navalny, but to frighten him away. Yeah, that would make sense. After all, many of Putin's previous opponents have, in duress or fear, permanently left Russia. When Mr. Putin agreed to allow Mr. Navalny's evacuation to Germany for treatment, he in all likelihood felt sure the man would not come back. And it was a fair bet. Over the years of Putin's power, the more people have had access to automobiles, appliances, and consumer electronics, the more they've consented to limitations on their freedom and political activity. Putin probably felt sure that Navalny was like the others, that between prison in Russia and life of comfort in Europe, he would choose the latter. But Putin miscalculated. Even before completing his treatment in Germany, Mr. Navalny stated that he was going back to Russia. He even publicly announced his flight number and departure time. Once arrived, he was immediately arrested at passport control. There followed an emergency hearing at a local police precinct, several weeks in a Moscow jail, and then sentencing to over 2 years in a penal colony. At every step, Mr. Navalny released statements on social media through his lawyers, his trademark humor and self-confidence visible throughout. Even when in jail, his legs started to fail and he demanded to see his doctors, he made a joke about it. He said that he had gotten used to his leg and didn't want to lose it. Sounds like the comedy of one Vladimir Zelensky. It was the behavior of a brave, proud, unbroken man standing up to an inhumane system whose weapons are prison and violence, an archetypical plot familiar to any country that's experienced dictatorship. Mr. Navalny's condition, certainly at times dire, seems to have stabilized. There could be no assurance of his safety as long as he languishes in prison. The prospects for the opposition movement, not least after the activities of the Anti-Corruption Foundation, which is Mr. Navalny's newer political organization, were suspended on Monday, look bleak. As for Putin, well, he's discovered the folly of refusing to face his opponent honestly. The protests that swept across the country last week after major demonstrations in support of Mr. Navalny in January attest to the strength of Navalny's appeal and, more important perhaps, to the depth of everyday Russians' dissatisfaction with their ruler, Vladimir Putin. This was of Putin's own doing. By not recognizing Mr. Navalny's right to participate in politics, Putin brought himself into a confrontation with a leader who is his equal. Now, after getting rid of all his opponents, real and imaginary, Putin finds himself alone. Just like the queen in the Russian fairy tale, who every day asks a mirror, "Who's the fairest of them all?" He desperately craves supremacy. Perhaps that's why Ukraine is now getting the brunt of this feeling. But when he asks the mirror whose Russian true leader is, the mirror answers back, Alexei Navalny. Well, thank you, Oleg Kashin, for your poignant words. That's, again, in today's New York Times, if you only heard part of that. Very compelling writing, and I was glad to have caught it. Well, let's stop there. We'll be back after another short break. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time, welcome back to Financial Survival. Dave Allen here. For all your precious metal needs, call Melody at 1-800-375-4188. Our latest American Survival newsletter hit the streets yesterday. You can sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs at dgscoins.com. DGScoins, one word, .com. Just look for the mailbox and enter your email address. In this week's edition, in addition to Melody's weekly market update, you'll find another thorough article from Doug Nolan of the Credit Bubble Bulletin blog called Inklings of Secular Change. A lot of very useful information and perspectives of Doug. There's also Food for Thought by Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs on how AI, artificial intelligence, will predict the next pandemic. And an article by me titled The Fed is Off and Running. In that vein, the economy certainly doesn't want for problems. There are plenty of them, both at home and stemming from rising geopolitical volatility across the world, particularly now in Eastern Europe. But as Neil Irwin writes for Axios, wherever the movers and shakers of the Federal Reserve look right now, they're seeing flashing green lights that the world wants them to get moving on raising interest rates. Well, that's not unanimous, but yes, the Fed, in theory, acts independently based on its best analysis of economic data. But other factors shape the tone and outcomes of those internal debates, too, like discussions by outside economic thinkers and financial market reactions to potential and actual Fed moves. Right now, Irwin believes those reactions are almost uniformly pointing toward more aggressive action to try to rein in high inflation. In fact, Fed future traders say another rate hike by the Fed's May meeting is really a done deal. 38.4% see a hike of 50 to 75 basis points, while 61.6 see a hike of 75 to 100 basis points. Remember, as Kelsey Williams reminded us in his latest Goldspot blog, the real purpose of the Fed is to provide a structured system whereby its member banks can create and lend money in perpetuity. How does the Fed do this? By continually expanding the supply of money and credit. After all, the Fed is of, by, and for the banks. The Fed exists for the benefit of banks and their bankers. Their reason for being is simply not aligned with the needs of everyday Americans. The Treasury, in tandem with the Fed, continually expands the supply of money and credit by issuing bonds, notes, and bills. Williams points out the money received from the sale of Treasury securities is credited to the Treasury and subsequently spent to pay the government's expenses, again, thus putting more money back into circulation. But the newly issued Treasury securities are in circulation as well and further increase the supply of money and credit. This monetization of debt is fundamentally, in Williams' words, an act of inflation. Unless we forget, since the Fed's inception in 1913, it's resulted in the decline in Americans' purchasing power by 99%. That's inflation. Fed Chair Jerome Powell addressed the National Association for Business Economics yesterday. He faced a room full of people who think the Fed's policy is too loose, 77% of them. versus 22% who think it's about right. Now, NAIB consists of economists working in industry who tend to have a more practical on-the-ground view of business conditions than their academic counterparts. At 77% is the highest share to hold that view since the question has been asked dating back to 1995. Also, 78% of the respondents thought it likely or very likely that inflation will remain above 3% next year. It's a bad sign for how embedded inflationary pressures are becoming, at least relative to the Fed's goal of 2%. Though admittedly, it's a lot better than 8%. But it's not just business economists sending the Fed the all-clear sign on a move toward tighter economy. Market's adjustment to the beginning of the interest rate hiking campaign has been relatively well behaved, especially given the disarray emerging from Eastern Europe. After last week's Fed policymaking meeting, Powell signaled that the Fed's likely to raise interest rates significantly over the next couple of months and begin shrinking its balance sheet. In fact, raising six or seven times in 2022 alone. But the market, somewhat surprisingly, didn't react too negatively, as they had in some past episodes, when the Fed announced more aggressive tightening plans. Longer-term bond yields were stable too, up slightly last week, as opposed to December 2018, when yields fell steeply, in a sign that the Fed's rate hikes then, or their plans, were a mistake and would lead to lower growth. Well, stock markets have gone on a tear following last week's rate hike rather than plunging like in past episodes. And it's true in the political sense as well. I mean, President Biden has said repeatedly that he trusts the Fed to take necessary action to bring down inflation. And that suggests there won't be much, if any, pushback from the administration to its planned rate hike campaign, and well, at least for now. See how it gets as we get closer to November. Irwin says that none of this means an aggressive rate-raising campaign will be painless or even that it's the right policy path. It only means that at this point, Powell and company have more outside pressure to speed up the tightening than to slow it down. And so, the Fed's off and running. And the rest of us, well, we're just going to have to find a way to keep up with it. Yeah, Bloomberg News, Joe Wiesenthal writes that for a long time there was this notion of a Fed put. The idea that if the stock market fell too much, we'd get interest rate cuts or other Fed easing that would stabilize things. But Wiesenthal observes today that with inflation running well above target and at multi-decade highs, it would take a lot for the Fed to worry about a stock market sell-off. In fact, that's been proven. I just mentioned stocks fallen substantially from their highs, yet the Fed went ahead and hiked rates last week and made clear that it intends to hike several more times over the coming year. But now there's another possibility. Wiesenthal thinks we could have a Fed call. Well, maybe the Fed's downright uncomfortable with stocks going up here. Last week, in addition to the Fed's rate hike, we got a surprising soaring stock market. S&P gaining 6.2% for the week. NASDAQ 100 gained more than 8. Economist Larry Summers warned that the market was wrong to rally so hard in response to the Fed. Or as Wiesenthal characterized it, Summers warned that the market's bullish response to the Fed was de facto evidence that Powell and company are still being too easy, not taking a hard enough line on inflation. Thus, these signs that the Fed may raise rates 1/2 to as much as 1%, percentage point, that is, in April. Then yesterday, we heard from Powell again that everyone seemed to think he sounded considerably more hawkish than he did the previous week. Last Wednesday, Powell said monetary policy works through financial conditions And so tighter financial conditions are the means by which the Fed's new policy stance will actually constrain inflation. Thus, you have to think that the Fed hiking last week, financial conditions easing dramatically thanks to the huge surge in the stock market. And then yesterday, you have Powell coming back, taking a seemingly more hawkish tone. Perhaps what it means is that the Fed chair agrees somewhat with Larry Summers' op-ed that the stock market surge was not consistent with what the Fed is going for here, that it doesn't want to be seen as just hoping for inflation to roll over, and that it wants to be active in making sure this period of high prices is stamped out. Of course, the S&P finished yesterday basically flat after having been down close to 1% at one point, though it is up again today. So in any event, if Powell did intend to express discomfort with the rally, that is, the stock market, or at least convey something new to the market, it didn't really go too well. Okay, last today. Never doubt Wall Street zeal to take advantage of a crisis and find some convoluted way to make more money. The public be damned. As the headlines in mainstream media grew more alarming in late 2021 regarding Russia's troop buildup around Ukraine, about $225 million a day, $13.7 billion over a two-month span, had been waged in bets that Russia might default on its sovereign debt. These bets are known as credit default swaps, and they can be used to hedge exposure or simply speculate on a debt default in hopes of making a profit. That sound familiar, ladies and gentlemen? The Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation reported that during the period of September 20th last year through December 19th, an average of 26 trades per day were being made in the credit default swaps on the Russian Federation sovereign debt. The trading activity for that 15-month period was 4.5 times the daily volume of $50 million in credit default swaps as executed on their debt for the equivalent period the year before. The big problem with the DTCC's swap repository is that it fails to share with the public the names of the parties. Well, we know they're typically too big to fail banks, the ones that are buying and selling protection via the credit default swaps on Russian debt. Thus, public doesn't always know if the bank where they hold their life savings and federally insured deposits might be on the hook to pay out billions of dollars if Russia were to default on its debt. By the way, Russia's debt is currently rated junk by three major credit rating agencies, with Fitch saying default is imminent, although they reportedly yesterday paid interest on the first batch due. Credit default swaps have been compared to buying insurance on your neighbor's house and then hoping it'll burn down. They played a major role in the financial collapse of Wall Street in 2008. And Wall Street megabanks didn't know how much exposure to credit default swaps each other had then, but they knew about $41 trillion in face amount was outstanding. So the banks simply backed away from lending to each other, which seized up the credit markets. As it turned out, the giant insurer, AIG, was one of those that had amassed giant exposure to these swaps. AIG failed, and the federal government was forced to take it over to prevent a domino effect of more mega failures. Now, one would have thought that the lessons from the Great Recession, the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, would have led Congress to outlaw credit default swaps. It hasn't. That's because Wall Street's campaign money, the revolving door of big bankers in and out of high-level government positions, and the legions of lobbyists mean that Wall Street continues to get what it wants from Congress. In other words, screw the national interest. If you have any doubt about the danger still lurking in the credit default swap arena, consider that in 2020, JPMorgan Chase and Citibank had just shy of $3 trillion in exposure to those swaps. Instead of being a source of strength as the pandemic raged in the spring of 2020, J.P. Morgan Chase had lost 39% of its common equity capital. 39%. Citigroup, parent of Citibank, lost 52%. For Congress and federal regulators to be allowing Citigroup, of all banks, to be selling credit default swap protection is beyond the pale. Citigroup received a far larger bailout than AIG during the Great Recession. In fact, it was the largest banking bailout in global banking history. The U.S. Treasury injected $45 billion of capital into Citigroup. There was a government guarantee of over $300 billion on some of its assets. And the FDIC provided a guarantee of $5.8 billion on its senior unsecured debt, $26 billion on its commercial paper and interbank deposits, and secret revolving loans from the Fed funneled a cumulative $2.5 trillion in below-market rate loans to Citigroup from 2007 to the middle of 2010. Time and time again, ladies and gentlemen, we learn that the major financial interest institutions and their major regulator, the Fed, can't be trusted to act in our own best interest, only their own. Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll return on Thursday. Butch will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Todd, and to you, our loyal listeners, for tuning in to Financial Survival. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye.